Tēnā koe, Vice-Chancellor. Tēnā koe, Professor Lyons. Tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome everyone. It's really great to see so many people here, both from within the university and also guests from outside of the university. I said see so many, but in fact I have to admit to going to the optometrist this afternoon and he put some drips in my eye. So I'm actually having trouble seeing anything. So I'm hoping it will wear off by the time the lecture starts, though. The Vice-Chancellor is just back from overseas, so she's asked me if I would open this, the latest inaugural professorial lecture to be given by Professor Carl Lyons. And the other DVCs also send their apologies as they're off campus at the moment. Helen Nicholson is overseas and Richard Blakey is elsewhere in New Zealand. Like the Vice-Chancellor, I regard IPLs as the high point of my week, the opportunity to be reminded of why I'm so privileged, the opportunity to learn from our brightest and best scholars within the university. I especially want to remind you that the Faculty of Dentistry is ranked 12th in the world, according to the QS World Rankings. Last year, we just beat Harvard University. This year, they just beat us. Next year, we'll thrash them. And something I discovered today for the first time, that if you look at the QS rankings and you look down the list and you look at dentistry, you'll find that we are the first 5-star-plus university on the list, which I think is quite impressive, really. A special welcome to Carl's family, Carl's wife Kate here, and their two daughters, Brenna, aged 11, who is leaning on, and India, who is leaning on Kate at the moment. IPLs are very special events, as you know, and tonight is no exception. In a moment, we will get an introduction from the Dean of the Faculty of Dentistry, Professor Paul Brunton, and he'll provide us with a brief biographical sketch of Carl's outstanding career. And I know I've said this before, but I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to focus on how difficult it is to actually become a professor at the University of Otago. And the reason I want to do that is it's only a couple of weeks since I convened a meeting where we considered applications from people wishing to be associate professors and also people wishing to be professor. And every year I'm absolutely flabbergasted by the quality of the applications that come forward. But true to our Scottish canniness, Otago does not hand out its personal professorships easily. To get promoted to professor, Carl would have to have achieved outstandingness in research, in teaching, and also in service. And the latter is expected to be both professional and university-based. Carl has both in abundance. He is said by his colleagues to be a quiet doer, whatever that means. Strong evidence of leadership is also required. And we seek the opinion of two or more international referees from around the world, from very good institutions. And we also appoint an anonymous moderator to give the committee advice. So without breaching confidentiality, in Carl's case, the referees were unanimous in their praise and support for Professor Lyons' promotion. Paraphrasing his referees, Carl is an excellent academic who coordinates the preeminent postgraduate prosthodontics program in Australasia. Carl is an outstanding researcher who also gives his time willingly to mentor early career researchers and students. And Carl is highly regarded for both his personal and professional qualities. So without further ado, let's get on with this evening's event.
Thank you very much for coming tonight. Thank you, Vice Chancellor, for coming. It was a real surprise, very pleasant surprise to see you there. I hope I didn't look too bad. Thank you also, Professor Squire, for your very kind welcome, although I would say that I'm quietly dour rather than a quiet doer. Thank you, Professor Brunton and Professor Crampton. Thank you also to all of you for coming today. Some of you might have wondered about the title. My wife said,
"All I want for Christmas is my two front tips. My two front tips. See my two front tips."
And I'd like to acknowledge the help of John Broughton as well with coming up with the title, because we were sitting outside my office and I was saying, well, I can't really come up with something like adhesion of microorganisms to obturators on the second day of July, because that might stop people coming. And so we were talking away and he suggested that title after we'd talked about quite a few others, and there it was. What I'd like to do over the next however long it takes is just give you a little bit of an outline about myself, how I happened to come here, not the exact details, but overall. A little bit about my journey into dentistry, academic career, a little bit, some snippets of my research, and then a whole bunch of thank yous that all take up the rest of the time. So this was a happy times for my parents. It was all about to change, I admit, but this was taken in the 60s, and this was the happiest day of their life, apparently, and this was one of their less happy days when a little lions appeared on the scene when my father, who was in the army at the time, was stationed in Malacca in Malaysia. And just having been to Malaysia and having the opportunity to go to Malacca, I was certainly hit, particularly because I was there at the time when it was snowing here in Dunedin, by the next place that my father was stationed to, which was Wairau. And the temperature difference when I was in Malaysia compared with the snow in Dunedin was 38 degrees, and I think it was probably a lot greater difference here, so this is me probably saying holy heck. But things got a lot better for my parents with the arrival of my brother Brett and my sister Carmen, and it got better again as they got older, but sadly I haven't really matured that much in this time. With the nature of the work that my father had with being in the army and then the Ministry of Transport and the police, we got to travel around a little bit, and the advantage with that was I got to see a reasonable number of schools in both the North and the South Island. But finally, we arrived in Dunedin in 1982, and I ended up at Otago Boys for the last 3 years of school. During my childhood as well, I got involved with swimming sports. It happened sort of quite by accident. Well, it wasn't by accident. My mother was ashamed that she'd taken us to a swimming pool at Sockburn in Christchurch, and my brother and I, despite her having spent dollars on 5 sessions for us to learn to swim, we could barely keep our heads above the water. So she joined us up to a swimming club. We didn't know what was ahead of us, and fortunately nor did my parents, because we became competitive swimmers, and which is a bit of a shame for my wife, because she knows through me what competitive swimming is all about, and my daughter Brenna is quite interested in becoming an Olympic swimmer, which Kate is quite enthusiastic about. Also, I'd like to thank my parents. The good thing about having parents and paper is that they like to cut things out about their children, and worse, they like to keep them. And at the time, it's not that much fun, but as you get older and you look back and think, I looked better in that photograph than I do now, you think, okay. So swimming became water polo, as well as surf life saving, and I even gave surfing a go, but really that didn't work for me so well. But around that time, I was needing to think about what was going to be ahead for me as a career. And another one of those funny things that happened with life was that I had a dental checkup. It was probably my last free dental checkup. That hasn't changed. And my dentist that I went to said, "What are you going to do next year?" And I said, "Medicine or pharmacy." And he said, "Have you thought of dentistry?" And I said, "Nope." And he said, "Well, there are dentists that don't actually do a filling after the day they graduate." And I thought, "Well, maybe that could be for me." So I went and found out about it and found that the Masters in Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery was just about to start. And I thought, "That's me." So I applied for dentistry with a day to go, which clearly you couldn't do in the current environment, but you could in the 80s when I did that. So I was in dentistry as an undergraduate student in the 80s, and I've got St John there as well, and I've got my friend Doug, third here as well, who I met, that St John was the other part of my life as an undergraduate student, as an ambulance volunteer through that time. Which also I continued when I graduated for a period of time as a volunteer, which was a really great experience and quite helpful sometimes in the clinics. So in 1989, I graduated and thought that I needed a job. So I had a job as a house surgeon, dental house surgeon in Christchurch, and then some time in private practice before returning to do postgraduate study in prosthodontics at Otago, as Paul mentioned. And I also had the opportunity to go back in time, just to make sure you didn't miss this slide, to go to UCLA to do maxillofacial prosthetics. It was a bit of a journey that caused some difficulty, but the opportunity was fantastic. And UCLA is quite a big university, probably a similar size to Dunedin. Well, probably not, but the number of cars that travel into UCLA a day is equivalent to the population of Dunedin. The dental school there is only a small part of it in yellow. But the thing about doing the maxillofacial prosthetics program was the opportunity to really get a huge amount of clinical experience in the area of maxillofacial prosthetics, as well as doing a small research project. So some of you might be wondering what maxillofacial prosthetics is. So I've got some pictures here that you might not all like, but I had them, so I had to show them. So one of the things that we're involved in doing in maxillofacial prosthetics is providing prostheses for patients that have lost part of their face, whether it's a nose, eye, ear. Primarily for me, as a result of cancer, the involvement in this area outside of cancer is not so great because we've got great surgeons, and the surgeons can work with tissues in road traffic accidents and with congenital disorders and put people back together, whereas with cancer it's much more difficult. And this is just showing a sort of a sequence of pictures from a patient presenting and then through the process of how we make the prosthesis, including painting to the end. But we also do other prostheses on the face, noses, ears, eyes, as well as obturator prostheses, where people have had to have some of their top jaw, had a maxillectomy removed. And this particular thing here, an obturator prosthesis, really became the basis of what was to be an important part of the research for the PhD that I did a little later. The thing about maxillofacial prosthetics, in exactly the same way as the thing about being an academic, is it's a team. You work in a team and you rely on the team, and everyone has their strengths that contribute so much to that. And this is not the whole team, but just shows, you know, in this particular discipline, when you're working with people, particularly with cancer, the number of people that are involved in their care. And for me, the main people that I work with are on here. We've got an absolutely fantastic team of surgeons along here. We've got Lyndall Kelly here. I apologise, Lyndall, you're not here, but I couldn't find a picture of you. But we're so privileged with the people that we have, and that for people that end up with head and neck cancer in Dunedin or in Otago, the care that they can get is just outstanding. These three people are the key people that I work with in the dental school with maxillofacial pros, as well as the postgraduate students and anyone else that's interested. And I thank all of these people for what they do and the opportunity to work with them. When we look at a patient who has had a maxillectomy, so some of their top jaw removed, really the sequence that they follow, you know, starts with the diagnosis. Then they'll go to the operating room where they'll have the cancer removed, so that they end up with the part of the jaw that's removed. And then this is where I get involved here with making a prosthesis and obturator that fits into this hole, so that the people can eat and speak and drink without it all coming out, the abnormal way. A lot of patients end up needing radiotherapy, and that's really a tough time for people during that time. And so for people that have had this sort of surgery, I'm quite involved and see these people a lot during this period of time, because it's a very, very difficult time for them in their life. And then once we've got through that, we move to making the final prosthesis. So this occurred once I'd started my academic career, but to go back just a bit, around the time that I was looking for the possibilities of an academic career, there were two positions that came up in the department. I was unsure which one I was suited for as a new master's graduate, but after I'd thought about it for about 5 seconds, or actually half a second, I felt that probably this one was a bit above me for the moment, but funnily enough, it ended up being the position that I got about 15 years later. So I applied for this. The university was desperate and made an appointment, and so began my career as an academic. I've got three people up here that were absolutely key in my development. Two are here, Peter and Brian. The difference that you made for me as I was developing as an academic, I can't thank you enough. The other person is John Buma, who was the person that ran the program that I did at UCLA, and the opportunities that have arisen from working with him have been outstanding, and also how much he's given back to us, and that he's been coming to on with his own money, well, actually the money he earns at UCLA with patient treatment, but with his own money, coming to Dunedin, teaching our postgraduate students and paying his own accommodation. It's not to say that these three are the only people that have contributed. Tom Cardos, who's here, and many others have made a difference to me, and I thank you all. The front row here probably see this one a lot, or variations of it. And it really it just forms the basis of the work that we're doing, the combination of teaching, of doing research, and of our contribution to the university and also to the community that we work in. Not only the community we live in, but the professional organisations that we work with. The other way of looking at it is like this, where as an academic we have all these different events or people giving us help and suggestions on exactly what and how we should be doing and spending our time. In terms of the roles, teaching, I've just got one slide that really represents the teaching. You know, teaching is one of the key things that we do at the university. The students are key to us. And they make a difference. You know, the thing about our undergraduate students is they don't age. I do, but they don't. And, you know, we have the opportunity in the dental school to be able to make a difference. We teach these people to become professionals, and the difference that we see from the day they walk in the door, the growth that they go through, how they mature and become a young professional is just a privilege, as is working in this university. And this is... This slide just shows the 28 people that have gone through the postgraduate prosthodontic program in the time that I've been involved with it. And they're all friends and colleagues. Well, maybe the bottom four aren't friends at the moment. They probably don't like me very much. But actually, and the person on the top right. But all the rest are good friends and colleagues that I really enjoy seeing them and seeing how they've grown. And they also like to see how I haven't grown. In terms of service, Professor Brunton mentioned some of the aspects that I've been involved with in terms of service, both to the professional organisations within New Zealand and also our own professional organisations, which is really good because these things are things that we can take from the university and use our knowledge and our skills that we learn from our research and from our clinical skills and knowledge and give back to our profession and give back to the organisations that make a difference for them to hopefully be better. The third part is research. And you know, we're a research-led university and research really underpins what we do and it helps inform what we do and it gives us the expertise that we have that the strength that we can say this is why this is. And this applies for everyone except me. So thankfully I'm surrounded by really good people. So I'm just going to now just do a brief overview of some of the research that I've been involved with over the years with a whole lot of people that I'll thank as I go along. Now I mentioned maxillofacial prosthetics and that was the basis of the PhD that I did. And the question really came when I was doing the residency program at UCLA. The John Bumer said that we should use a particular kind of material, an acrylic as opposed to a silicone, for the obturators because candida will bind or stick to those materials, to the silicones, and they just wear out. And I thought, okay, is that true? And so began what was a relatively long PhD that took a reasonable amount of time. But I thank my supervisors, Richard Cannon, Robert Love and Anne Holmes, for their patience. They were a lot younger when I started that. For the purposes of what I'm going to talk about just briefly, these were the aims of the study, which was to investigate really whether candida does adhere any more to certain materials than others and to investigate what some of the influences of that might be. And as a reminder, this is the prosthesis that I'm talking about, the obturator prosthesis that fits up into this hole. During the course of the study, I saw there were about 20 patients that were in the study that had maxillectomies, and the sad fact about seeing patients that have got these kind of tumours is that the vast majority of them died during the course of the study, which is really hard, but thankfully this person didn't. So I managed to get quite a long period of time with this person. And really what this slide shows is the cycle of how much of the candida is adhering to the material over time. So these times are where we've made a new prosthesis, and this is as the prosthesis is getting older. And so we see that we have a cyclical event here, that as the prosthesis gets older, more candida is sticking to it, and then when we make a new one or replace it, then we've got a nice clean surface that the candida doesn't adhere to as well. This part over here is where this particular person, this isn't so common to occur. This person, after 6 years, developed a recurrence of their tumour and had to get radiotherapy. And so what this is showing here is the amazing increase in the adhesion of candida, so the stuff that causes thrush during that period of time. And it really, the amount of the adhesion really is quite incredible. And what we did was we did some swabs of the prostheses for patients that were getting radiotherapy and patients that weren't. And this particular one here, you can see that for the total percentage of the microorganisms that were detected, in some cases, more than 60% of it was taken up by candida. And so the amount of candida is quite amazing, and the tissues show it. You know, when we look in the mouth for these people, you know, I said earlier that the process for people that are getting radiotherapy is really not very nice. And within the mouth really does get really red and ulcerated and sore and uncomfortable. And this shows some of the different classifications of it with ulcers around through here. And there's a really big ulcer here and here. And all of the tissues, all of the patients that get radiotherapy get thrush, which is caused by candida, 100% of people. But how much of a problem it is really varies between patients. So one of the things that we found was that patients that had a really massive increase in colonisation of candida in the first week all ended up getting hospitalised because of consequences or secondary effects from the radiotherapy, whereas those that had a slower increase in candida adhesion didn't. We had to do some stuff in the lab as well, and so we were looking at the materials. So these materials here are the hard acrylics that I use, because these ones over here are the silicones. And really what we've found here is that when we don't have saliva involved, the adhesion of candida to the acrylics is less than adhesion to any other material. When we put saliva in, the candida sticks even more, but is still lower with the hard acrylics than it is for any of the other materials. We were wondering why, what role saliva might have, and so that ended up taking a few years and a bit of work to find that out. But ultimately we ended up using mass spectrometry, found a particular salivary protein that was related to the adhesion of candida, so it facilitated the adhesion of the candida to the materials that we were using. So that took and is still taking sort of the research time that I'm involved with. And then a lot of these other ones now are collaborations with other people. And all of these people that I'm going to show, thank you. Dental implants came along, have been around for some time, but really was some research that was done in the 60s that was done well. And was the patients were followed for a long time before any of the data was published. They found that implants in the jaw to hold prostheses in work. And nowadays implants can be used to replace where there's a few teeth missing and still some teeth, where there's no teeth, where there's one or two teeth. But they're particularly good for people that have had their teeth out, and where the bone, once the teeth get taken out, the bone shrinks away to you end up with really not very much, and really not very much for a denture to sit on. And so this is where the implant overdenture came along, where you've got two implants that are put in the jaw with a clip on them, and then the clips clip into the denture here and hold the denture in place so it doesn't move around. And Otago is internationally recognised for work that was started here in the late 90s. And these are some of the people that are absolutely key in the work that's been done and is still being done in this area. And that includes some work that I was involved with. A lot of the work that was done initially was really on placing implants, placing these kind of implants in the jaw, and then following patients over time to see what sort of maintenance was needed on the components, because it just helped to provide information about which things work better than others. And interestingly enough, even when this study was done, some of these implant systems now have been replaced by others because they've failed. And really what we found was that there is a difference in the components, that some components work better than others. And the ones that don't work end up being discontinued and replaced by something else that commonly doesn't work either. And what about the fit of the components? You know, when we look at an implant here, and we've got, you know, these metal bits that are fitting onto the implant, they need to fit really well, because if they don't fit closely but without putting a load on the implant, then there's a risk that the implant is going to de-osseointegrate, i.e. fall out of the bone, or that the components that are holding the prosthesis in place are going to break and wear out. And this is just an example here of the complexity of some of the components that go together to make up a set of upper teeth for some people. And it's absolutely essential that these fit what we call passively in the mouth. And so this was some work that we did with Jaffa, who was a postgraduate student at the time, who developed a technique that could be used and was quite successful in evaluating passivity of fit of components to implants. And also we found that certain techniques for making prostheses to fit was variable. Some things fitted well, some things didn't. Some things didn't fit then. Now, like some of the computer designed components that now are fitting better with improvements in technology. Another area that we've really been fortunate to be involved with, because of some of the people that we've had working here and that we've still got here, are ceramics. And this picture here just shows, you know, for these two patients over here, what we've done is we've used a glass or a ceramic to improve the appearance of the teeth, will hopefully improve the appearance of the teeth, maybe help the bank balance of the people that were doing it, but improve the appearance of the teeth. And because of the development of some of the techniques that are available now in dentistry with the digital designs, computer-aided diagnosis and computer-aided manufacturing, and some of the other techniques, the availability of ceramics for use in dentistry has really just gone ahead. And so this particular slide just shows a whole bunch of examples of the way that ceramics can be used in the mouth now because of the way we make them that we could never have done in the past. And the principal aim, you know, when we're doing, you know, anything like this, is to make something that blends in. And how good a job we do that, we really rely on, you know, partly us, but really on the technicians that make the work for us. They're the ones that make us look good. But some of the problems with the ceramics, and particularly the zirconia, the ceramic steel, is that that particular ceramic doesn't behave in the mouth the way that some of the other materials that we use in the mouth, like the crowns that we use with a metal base with porcelain on top. But the technicians were treating them the same. And so what we were finding, particularly when the zirconias were introduced into dentistry in the mid, about 2005, 2006, is that so all of a sudden we had this really strong material that dentists thought, well, I can use this material to put on any tooth, including a back tooth. But what we were finding was that the material was fracturing, which gave us a question: why is it chipping? And at the time we had Mike Swain working for us, who is an international expert in the area of ceramics. We also had Basil, who was a postgraduate student, and thankfully we had Neil as well. So we set about asking the question about why things are chipping. So we started off with a review that Mike Swain had proposed a possibility for why things could be fracturing. But we went on to look at that a little bit further. And really what we found was that the dental technicians in making the crowns with zirconia were treating the crowns in exactly the same way as they were using with metal. But unfortunately, the way metal and the zirconia behave are completely different. And it was causing stress in the ceramic, the way the technicians were working with it, that caused the porcelain to break. So once it was found a way to work around that, which was just changing the way that the porcelain was managed, the problem was more or less solved. Another project that I've been fortunate to get involved with is a PhD project that's ongoing at the moment with Joanne. And for patients that have tooth wear, which is quite a common thing for people, is there are a number of thoughts about why this happens. And one of the reasons why people think it might happen is because of variations in saliva flow and pH in the mouth. And if you have extended fluctuations of pH in the mouth where the mouth is particularly acidic, the teeth can dissolve. And so the device here really that was used was that the project started off when Jules Keyser was here before he tragically died. But the opportunity to really work with Joanne and with Neil and having this develop further, you know, Joanne was able to develop a device that for the first time could record data, and the device could be left in the mouth for an extended period of time that was relatively, in terms of dentistry, which is, you need to remember that relative is quite extreme, comfortable, but would collect data over a 24-hour period, which really gave us some really good information about fluctuations that occur with pH in the mouth. And that work's still ongoing, and really what we've developed to the point now is that we've got this device that reliably works, is comfortable to wear, which is really set now to be used for sort of much greater uses that we were talking about yesterday. The Vice-Chancellor likes these pictures. She was saying she was looking forward to some pictures of dentistry, and I didn't want to disappoint. Tooth decay is one of the most common diseases in the world. It affects a huge number of people, and it's a combination of us providing our mouth and the bugs in our mouth with the nutrition that it needs, that through the process of fermenting the carbohydrates that feed it, release an acid that then dissolves the teeth. Caries, you know, is generally, you know, managed fairly simply in the dental practice, but it can be quite a severe and can cause some quite extreme problems, including death. And I've got this picture over here just to show that it's not only humans that are affected by decay, it's also dogs. In fact, when we had our dog in at puppy training, we were told to make sure we brush the dog's teeth because of the risk of decay. So we've had some work that's been going on with modification of materials. This particular work with modification of glass ionomer cement with a nano-coated silver really came about from work that Don and Carla had done in developing nano-coated silver. And this was really an extension of this and was able to be incorporated into this material. And really the principal thing that was being investigated by Sid as a Declan Dent student was, could nano-coated silver particles be incorporated into filling material without affecting its properties so that we could use it in the mouth? And the answer is that in this case, yes, it can be done. The mechanical properties under certain conditions are similar to the material without the glass ionomer, without the silver. Another piece of work that we're just starting with the dean and Carolina with another Declan Dent student is, rather than modifying the material with silver, it's being modified with chlorhexidine. And that's really just starting. Another thing that's sort of emerging for us with digital technology, and really dental technology is going to be leading the way with this, is digital dentistry. And I mentioned it probably a bit early before, but CAD-CAM, computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacture, has been around in dentistry since the 80s. but was limited to an extent because of the ability of computers and processing power and milling, et cetera, but in the last 10 years, this technology has really advanced a long way, as has the development of 3D printing. And it's entirely likely that the way that we practice dentistry in 10 or 15 years will whether it's the combination of CAD/CAM and 3D printing or something that's a variation of it, it's really the future of what we're going to be doing and what we'll be teaching. And thankfully, with the new dental school, we're going to have the opportunity to put some of this technology into our building. And another piece of work that we're doing with another postgraduate student, Abdullah, is comparing a 3D printed chrome cobalt material, which chrome cobalt in the state that we use it in the mouth is extremely hard and difficult to work with. But thankfully, it's able to be worked with in a softer form, whether it's with 3D printing or with CAD/CAM. That makes it possible for us to use this material. And so Abdullah has been doing some really good work with this, comparing the quality of prostheses that can be made with 3D printed and CAD/CAM produced chrome cobalt, and found that 3D printed chrome cobalt can be printed well. And one of the things that's limiting us at the moment with 3D printing is really the availability of materials. We had a visiting professor here last year who did his PhD in the 1990s in 3D printing. And I asked him why we're really at where we are, and he said patents. It's patents that have held things up. Computing as well has held it up, but there's also some exciting work. And the university has spent a bit of money in purchasing a really high-quality 3D printer that chemistry are getting. Just something that comes about really because of the opportunity to work with lots of other people, social responsibility. And this was work that really I've had the opportunity to work that's been led by Lindy, but also work with John in bioethics. Looking at the community and some of the things in the community and social responsibility in dentistry has only relatively recently been looked at. And the findings with social responsibility in dentistry really, I think, are similar to what they're finding in medicine, that while dental students feel that they have a responsibility to their community and to their patients, they feel that it's the state that should have responsibility overall for making sure that dentistry is available for all rather than necessarily that they should be responsible for that. But there's more work that's going on with that, that Callum, who's a final year dental student, is involved in doing at the moment. And now my last few slides of research, really a future. This is some work that we've been talking about with Azam, and the Centre for Material Science and Technology. I had to change the slide from the department. It's really quite exciting, and it really extends from the work that he's done with others, including Navanya, using collagen scaffolding to make all sorts of different things. And particularly, they've done some work with making collagen-produced replacements for the dental pulp, and what we're wanting to do is to make something that can be used to restore and replace tooth tissue. Another piece of work with Eva Glias at the Polytech is looking at simulation. And this particular slide just shows the dental simulators that we have in the dental school at the moment, which are that we're able to put teeth in, and then they're designed to really replicate as closely as possible the dental chair without it actually being a dental chair. In the new building that we're getting, we're also getting these MOOGs, which are sort of virtual reality simulators, and Don has got quite an involvement in leading that project. But one of the things that we've been looking at with this is there another way that we can do it as well that is cheaper and doesn't take up as much space as the Moogs? And that's really looking at virtual reality and using the virtual reality goggles. Virtual reality has been used in aeronautics for a long time with teaching people how to fly and how to land at Wellington Airport. But nowadays there's all sorts of other things that are available with virtual reality, virtual patients, and game apps. And the thing that we're looking at is how can we put this all together to come up with a comprehensive experience for a student where, you know, we can use the virtual reality goggles that the students could look at, be in a relatively small space, that we can use computer program, that we can walk patients through an experience, whether it's seeing a patient for the first time and working through asking, you know, getting information from them or carrying out procedures. In terms of reflections in my time here, teamwork. Teamwork is the research that I've been involved with couldn't have happened without a team. It couldn't. We all have skills that we bring that add to what we do to make it bigger than any one person. And it's the same with teaching, and it's the same with everything that we do in the university. Another thing, particularly since I've had the opportunity to do the academic leadership program, was through going to the programs and meeting people, you end up meeting all these amazing people with this amazing knowledge that you didn't even know were around. And you make friends and you network and you're able to talk I'm thinking about this, what do you think? And normally when I say that, they laugh. But then when I listen to other people, you know, they'll have something, you know, that goes on. And when I think about the collaboration and the networking, I mean, I was at a program and I was just talking to one of the staff in tourism who had been doing some work in dental tourism. And one thing led to another, and we're just getting data at the moment on dental tourism around New Zealand. Mentoring, you know, I said at the beginning or near the beginning about the mentors that have made a difference in my life. And there comes a point where we have the opportunity to give back and to make a difference to the people that are here with us. And, you know, the people that hopefully I'm contributing to in whatever role that I have are the future of the university, and they're the future that I will either, you know, contribute to showing them how to be a mentor or how not to be. Communication, I'm doing it very poorly tonight, but communication is absolutely essential, whether it's communication with your colleagues, communication with patients, communication at home. Ethics and communication are fundamental in the way we interact with people. Change is constant. You know, we have a change. You know, Vice Chancellor and the university have supported us with a massive change that we have coming up. And I thank the university for, and the Vice Chancellor for that. I've got a series of thank you slides now. This one is to all the staff that I've worked with, that I couldn't do what I do without what you do. And a lot of the people, not all, are in this particular picture. Thankfully, we had pictures of the faculty taken. So to all of you even if I don't work with directly, thank you. Thank you to the students, because without you, we wouldn't be here. To the patients, you know, the patients that we have at the dental school are again why we're here. The patients that I treat, it's a privilege to treat them and to have the opportunity to interact with their lives. Thank you to my friends, and particularly those that are here tonight, and to Robert, who's watching, probably, and Johnny, family, including the family that can't be here tonight. My dad, who died last year, my mother-in-law, and my father-in-law and my brother-in-law. My two girls, light of my life, and my beautiful wife, who I needed to put this in or I'd die. And so, in the words of a program that some of you might have seen, thank you very much to all of you for coming tonight. And as they say in 7 days, I'm Carl Lyons and this is my picture.